True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Elaine O'Hara of South Dublin, Ireland, spent her life looking for love. Because of mental health issues, Elaine spent many of her years in the St. Edmundsbury Hospital, receiving psychiatric treatment for depressive disorder, self-harming behaviors, and 3 suicide attempts. As a result of this, she missed the usual social milestones of dances, dating, and boyfriends. In her 20s, she began to meet men online, and she did become involved in some masochistic behavior. Lonely and emotionally immature, Elaine was exceedingly vulnerable to online predators. In August of 2012, Elaine disappeared after a visit with her family. Investigators assumed that she had committed suicide by jumping off some nearby cliffs. But disturbing texts found on recovered cell phones later revealed that Elaine had been involved with a very dangerous man. Join us at the quiet end today for Groomed for Murder. Elaine O'Hara wanted to find a man to love her and eventually have a family of her own. But instead, she was tragically lured to her own murder by a cruel, sick man who was living a secret double life.
And before I do the beer review, and so I don't forget, the episode we're doing was suggested to us by a nice Irishman named Dara.
Yes, thank you, Dara.
Thank you for the tip. And we're going to review a beer called O'Hara's Irish Stout. Now, the fact that the victim is O'Hara, this is all serendipitous.
Well, I'm thinking that's a common name in Ireland, O'Hara.
Probably is.
Yeah.
So this Irish Stout is brewed by Carlow Brewing Company in County Carlow, Ireland. It's classified as an Irish dry stout, and it's 4.3% alcohol by volume. Not one of those beers you're going to be blasted with. It's a nearly black color, very dark brown, small tan head, has a nice aroma, coffee, some roasted malt, and mostly an espresso, dark coffee taste. It's fairly dry, and a good stout.
Yeah, is that a low amount of alcohol for a stout? I usually think of stouts as having higher alcohol than that.
Well, non-U.S. stouts would tend to be lower alcohol. In the U.S., we like to barrel age things, and 8 to 10, 12% is not uncommon. In the U.S., but this 4.3 is something you'd be likely to see in Ireland and Great Britain.
Well, and it's probably better if you're going to put down a few.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's open it up. So down here at the quiet end, not much going on.
Still quiet at the quiet end.
Still very quiet. Probably more quiet than we'd ever imagined.
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. But there are some nice things about quiet that I appreciate. So why don't you go ahead and start this really tragic, sad story.
This is. I just feel so much sympathy for this poor woman.
And her family.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Elaine O'Hara was born on St. Patrick's Day in 1976. She was the first child of Frank and Eileen O'Hara. So we got an Eileen and an Elaine. I'll try to keep that straight.
Eileen doesn't play a big part in this, so
okay.
It's okay.
Good. The couple lived in middle-class Killiney in South Dublin. Eileen was a teacher, and Frank worked for a bank. In 1978, their second daughter, Anne, was born. This was followed by Frank Jr. in 1982, and the youngest child, John, in 1984. Now, in 1986, when Elaine was 10 years old, the O'Haras moved to another area of Killiney. Elaine went to school where her mother taught. The school was called Our Lady of Good Counsel National School.
It's very specific.
It certainly
descriptive,
is.
Descriptive, yeah.
And when Elaine was 15, her parents learned that she was being bullied at school. And also during this time, a close friend of Elaine's was killed in a car accident. So these events were thought to trigger Elaine's underlying psychiatric issues of depression and anxiety. She had already been diagnosed with asthma and diabetes. So those aren't great diseases to have. Those are pretty chronic.
Yes.
The conditions were probably worsened because she didn't eat a very good diet, which is fairly essential for diabetes, and she smoked a lot, and that's not going to help her asthma.
No. So her mental health just really seemed to have an effect on everything in her life. Of course it would.
So it seems.
Yeah.
Her performance in school was also affected by her dyslexia. So all these things added up to her having chronic insecurity and poor self-esteem, and these issues led her to self-harm by cutting herself.
So a lot was going on with Elaine. When she was 16, her sister found her in the upstairs bathroom after Elaine had cut her wrists. Her family was really shocked by the suicide attempt. In August of 1992, her parents, Frank and Eileen, brought her to this really well-regarded psychiatrist who agreed to take Elaine on as a patient. And she was admitted for psychiatric diagnosis and treatment to the St. Edmundsbury Hospital in West Dublin. And she told the doctor she had fantasies of being tied up since she was 12 years old, and this was just the first in many admissions to this hospital. But after that hospitalization, Elaine spent the remainder of her teens very heavily medicated. She was on antidepressants and anti-anxieties, and a lot of these things made her sleepy.
Well, they sure will.
And kind of out of it. So it really made her miss out on what would be considered a normal teenage experience. With long stretches of time spent in psychiatric care, Elaine changed schools and completed her leaving certificate in central Dublin. She adored her children and wanted to be a teacher like her mom, but she just didn't have the academic abilities to complete the qualifications for that. And there's another thing that added to her sadness and her poor self-esteem.
Almost like it's a triple whammy on this poor kid.
Oh, at least, yes. I imagine in school she was picked on, and it probably wasn't pleasant for her to be in high school. It's not pleasant for most people, really, and for her it had to be really hard.
Yeah, you gotta hew to strict standards in high school, right?
Yeah, and she wasn't.
And she's not gonna do that.
No.
Or not be able to do that.
She had too much to deal with.
So she did take and complete a childcare course and got a job. So between February and May of 2000, she spent 3 months as an inpatient at St. Edmundsbury. Now, her diagnosis on this hospitalization was recurrent depressive disorder with a strong possibility of emotionally unstable personality disorder. Then in 2001, Elaine got a job as a child care assistant. This was in the primary school where her mother still worked. But in 2002, Elaine's mother died. She was only 52. And this was more bad news and devastation for Elaine. Eileen had been her biggest supporter, really looking out for her kid.
Yeah, so that was a lot to go through.
Just one more thing.
So that following year, Elaine spent her entire summer as a psychiatric inpatient. Her medical records show that she had been expressing suicidal ideation and that she was finding it difficult to think straight. In her therapy sessions, she expressed feelings of worthlessness and shared her fantasies about being restrained or controlled by a man. She also talked about self-harming and about having pain inflicted on her by others. So Elaine's poor self-esteem was seen in her changing appearance as well. She put on a lot of weight and just wasn't taking care of herself physically. Then in late 2003, Elaine enrolled in a night course to train as a Montessori teacher, and she was really excited about this. This was a big deal. She moved out of her dad's home in early 2005 and rented a room of her own. On St. Patrick's Day that year, her father and siblings threw a party to celebrate Elaine's 29th birthday. But Elaine was prone to these bouts of anger, and it sometimes led to arguments with her family, and that's what happened that day. Elaine became upset, and she ended up leaving the party, just kind of stomping out. And immediately afterwards, her sister Anne and Anne's husband went to check on Elaine at her place. But by the time they showed up there, Elaine had already taken an overdose of some of her medication. So they called the ambulance, and she had to be rushed to the hospital.
You know, she did recover from this, at least physically, and she went back to St. Edmundsbury for a 2-month stay. Now, the following year, Elaine was speaking with her father on the phone, and she told him that she had taken something. So he immediately drove to her house and found Elaine passed out on the floor. He then took her right to the nearest hospital, where she went into a coma that lasted almost 24 hours. After that incident, she was once again admitted to St. Edmundsbury for continued psychiatric care. Her hospital record notes her persistent thoughts of self-harm, along with suicidal thoughts. She was noted to have said, "I wasn't born for life. No one likes me. I'm a bad person." She was released in June, but then was readmitted in July for an additional 3 weeks. Now, the recorded reason for her readmission was that she believed people were watching her and talking behind her back. Starting to see some paranoia here. She was preoccupied with thoughts which she described as a play running in her head, and in this play she was being persecuted.
So then in 2007, Elaine's psychiatrist died, so that set her back even further emotionally. She did remain close to her family, but she didn't share with them the details of her personal life or her relationships like she would with her psychiatrist. She was close to her dad and would often ask him if he loved her, just for reassurance, and he always reassured her. He always told her that he did, no matter what. Frank tried to convince Elaine that she was special and tried to get her to see herself as he saw her. But of course, Elaine's depression and instability were just a constant source of worry for her family members. She argued with them, often becoming angry or agitated, and blurting out shocking statements. And these kind of things put distance between her and her family members.
During one argument with her father, and this was in early 2008, Elaine announced that she liked to be tied up and hurt by men for sexual pleasure. She told her father that she was seeing a married architect for repeated bondage sessions. She said, "He ties me up and masturbates over me. We haven't had sex." Then she said that she asked this man to kill her, but he had refused. As you can imagine, this really shocked Frank, and he left. He thought his daughter was making things up to disturb him and push him away.
Well, yeah, they did say that Elaine was prone to making up stories and exaggerating. She could be very flippant and just say things to shock people when she was angry.
Yeah, I can only imagine what was going through his mind when his daughter's telling him she liked to be tied up and hurt.
Well, unfortunately, I think he was used to that a little bit. Maybe not that specifically, but shocking things being said to him. So that spring, she told her therapist about the encounter with her father, and she described him as being speechless afterwards, and I imagine that was true.
He probably was.
Yeah.
Then the next couple of years, Elaine's life seemed to be a little more stable. But in July of 2011, Elaine told her therapist that she had been pregnant, but miscarried a few months earlier. In that November, she called her sister Anne to say that she had miscarried. She said the pregnancy was from her one-night stand.
So in the summer of 2012, Elaine began to feel very depressed and hopeless. One problem that set her off was her financial situation. In 2010, she'd purchased a one-bedroom apartment using a government housing assistance program, but she'd fallen over 4 months behind in her mortgage payments. Elaine had borrowed 6,000 euros from her father, but her income as a child care assistant didn't pay enough for her to be able to pay him back. It just seemed hopeless. Then she became very anxious about her upcoming exams for the Montessori teaching classes. Then after her apartment was flooded because the plumbing had not been installed correctly, she was just at the end of her rope. No pun intended, she considered hanging herself. But she knew enough about her condition to call the St. Edmundsbury Hospital and get help, so that was a really good thing that she did that.
Yes, it was. She told the hospital staff that she was suicidal again, so arrangements were made for her to be admitted the next day. St. Edmundsbury had become an important part of her life, a place where she did feel comfortable and safe. When Elaine told her father that she was returning to the hospital, he was surprised. He thought she seemed to be better. But he was reassured to know that Elaine would reach out herself for help when she needed it. That is kind of a triumph, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, if she can recognize her own difficulties and then seek out the help on her own, that's a very positive step in the right direction.
Certainly is.
So Elaine was admitted with increased anxiety and irritability. She showed signs of anti-hedonism, the inability to enjoy anything, and was having difficulty coping just with day-to-day life. She started having obsessions about a noose and hanging herself. The triggers blamed for this difficulty were her upcoming exams, the money problems, and of course the flooding. Elaine stayed in that hospital from July 14th to August 22nd. After her condition was stabilized, she could sign out on the weekends to work in a shop. Her risk of suicide was still classified as medium. Over time, Elaine began to improve. Then, around 11 a.m., Wednesday, August 22nd, she was discharged.
Then shortly after that, Elaine called into her local pharmacy. She had prescriptions for a month's supply of 11 different medications. This included medications for high cholesterol, diabetes, asthma, depression, anxiety, and insomnia. So this bill came to 132 euros. Elaine had no money, but she told the pharmacist that she would settle the bill when she got paid. And this had happened before with her, so the pharmacist agreed.
Which is remarkable, because nowadays you don't really think of anyone doing that for someone.
No.
No. Well, around 1:30 p.m. that day, Elaine went to visit her dad. Frank was babysitting his 2-year-old grandchild, who was also Elaine's godchild. And Elaine seemed to be in a good mood. She brought a toy watch and bracelet for her niece. And then she called the shop where she worked to tell them she wouldn't be available to work the next 2 days because she was volunteering at the Tall Ships Festival. And this was something she was really excited about. So the Tall Ships Festival in Dublin City Center was a significant event in Elaine's life, something she was really looking forward to for months. She had attended a training day for volunteering, and she had arranged to get a ride into town from her father's partner, Sheila, early in the morning. So Elaine had really suffered from a lack of confidence, and when she had been made a team leader for this festival, it was a big achievement for her. She was enthusiastic, and her family just saw this as very encouraging. You can imagine her family is constantly worried about her.
Oh.
It's just no way to live. It's horrible.
They must have gone day by day just wondering what was going to happen.
I know.
Sheila lived directly across the street from Elaine. Late Wednesday night, she didn't see any lights on or any movement in Elaine's apartment. That was unusual, but Sheila thought that Elaine must have gone to bed early to get ready for her big day ahead of her. So at 10:34 p.m., she sent Elaine a text message that read, "See you 7:15 a.m. Elaine never responded. Then the next morning, Elaine didn't show up to ride with her to the festival. So Sheila drove over to Elaine's apartment, rang the doorbell, tried Elaine's phone, no answer any place. Sheila then called Frank at 8:30 to tell him she couldn't find Elaine. Now, Elaine's sister Anne had also called Elaine twice on Wednesday evening. She hadn't heard from her either.
So later that Thursday, Frank went to Elaine's apartment and let himself in with the spare key that he had. No one was there, and her iPhone was plugged into the charger. So this was strange right off, because Elaine was never without her iPhone. But Frank guessed that maybe she'd overslept and then ran out in a hurry and forgot her phone. But that night, by 11:30 p.m., when Frank still hadn't heard back from his daughter, he sent her a text. And the text read, "Are you alive?" Of course, he didn't mean that literally. That was just something flip that they would say to one another. But Sheila, Frank's girlfriend, saw that there were still no signs of life in Elaine's apartment. And her car was not in its parking space in the garage. But she thought, well, maybe Elaine's just working late at the festival, and tried to just go on with things and not worry too much. But then early the next morning, Sheila checked Elaine's apartment again. Still no sign of Elaine or her car. So she called Frank, and he visited the apartment again, and they could tell that nothing had been moved since the day before. Her phone was still charging, and then Frank noticed for the first time that Elaine's purse was still there. So that was very odd. She hadn't come home at all overnight, apparently. So Frank called St. Edmundsbury Hospital and spoke to Elaine's doctor. And he confirmed that she hadn't returned to the hospital. She wasn't there.
So it's going on 2 days that she's been missing.
Yes.
Frank's heart sunk a little more after speaking to the organizers of the Tall Ships Festival. They told him that Elaine hadn't shown up. That surprised them, because she'd been very excited about her job as a team leader. They also had called Elaine, and also had not heard back from her. So it's getting to be more of a mystery.
And more worrisome. Because remember, this is someone with a significant psychiatric history, depression, suicide attempts.
Right. So he called his other grown children to ask for help. was searching for Elaine. He had a deep sense of dread that his daughter might have taken her own life. He went to the local Garda station to complete a missing person report, and certainly he and the rest of his family had good reasons to predict the worst.
So the Garda station, Garda is the state police force of the Irish Republic.
Right.
So that's what they call the police station.
Yeah, they were just thinking, all that Elaine's been through, she might have killed herself.
Well, sure, it's a distinct possibility. Her life had just been derailed from a young age by her mental illness.
While Frank and Anne were with the police, Anne's husband, Marcus Charles, drove out to the cemetery. He remembered that Elaine had visited her mother's grave there on Wednesday. So he gets there and he finds Elaine's blue Fiat parked on the road leading to the cemetery parking lot. Elaine's brother John drove out to the cemetery and called the Automobile Association to open her car.
Yeah, so inside of the car, they found Elaine's driver's license, two packs of cigarettes, a lighter, and very strangely, a charger from a different type of cell phone that Elaine was not known to use.
Yeah, something's amiss.
Yes. So investigators were called to the area to perform a search. Eileen O'Hara's grave was at the Shagana Cemetery, which is located on 70 acres, encompassed by a golf course, and there's a park, too. To the east of the park, there's rocky land and the Irish Sea coast. A path connects the park to the cemetery, and train tracks divide the park into two sections, which are connected by a footbridge. When they began their search, it was raining, and poor visibility forced the Garda helicopter to turn back after it arrived in the area. So when the search concluded at dusk, Elaine's family members were clearly upset. They returned to Elaine's apartment, where quite a few things had been found. Items found included two heavy metal chains, padlocks, a dress made of PVC, lubricant, ropes, and a gas mask. So Sheila told them that she had found a black latex bodysuit in a wicker laundry basket in Elaine's apartment the day before that, and she hadn't told Frank about it earlier because she didn't want to upset him even more. Elaine's brother John also found printouts of hunting knives and Google maps. One map was for the foothills of the Dublin Mountains. Another map was for a reservoir in a nearby village. Elaine had a notebook with the name of the website, FetLife.com, and John looked this up on his iPhone and was quite shocked. He had no idea that Elaine had this interest, and it was a site for people interested in BDSM, which stands for Bondage, Discipline, Domination, Submission, Sadism, and Masochism. So later on, John logged into this site and searched profiles using Elaine's gender, appearance, age, etc. And he found a profile with the username Chained Brunette, which could have belonged to Elaine. So he showed that to the investigators.
Then the next day, they did a more extensive search of the cemetery and the park. And a Coast Guard helicopter searched the shoreline and the water. This search went on for 2 days. Nothing was found. Back in Elaine's apartment, they found fetish paraphernalia and unusual documents. One document was titled, The Gurian Lifestyle, A Woman's Right as Slave. Her phone, laptops, and an old phone with a cracked screen were taken for analysis. There's CCTV footage around the apartment, and this was analyzed. When they went back to 4 p.m. Wednesday to make sure Elaine had made it home after visiting her father, she was seen returning home at 4:29 p.m. Then she had left again at 5:02 p.m. and returned just seconds later, and then at 5:05 she left again. And on the camera she is wearing dark blue tracksuit pants, white sneakers, and a lighter blue zip-up sweatshirt. She walked out to her car and drove away.
So one neighbor did confirm that he had seen Elaine in the underground garage when he got home from work Wednesday. He had honked to say hi, he said, but Elaine had ignored him and seemed distracted. At 5:12 p.m., cameras at the Sandyford Community Center recorded Elaine's car turning onto Hillcrest Road, and from then on her location and movements became unknown. But one strange thing was that Elaine was holding a cell phone, and that's even though her iPhone had been left inside of her apartment. And then remember the strange charger in her car as well. And no one remembered ever seeing Elaine with anything but her iPhone. But still, this is where the investigation seemed to go cold. A week later, detectives went back to the park and they canvassed people who regularly visited the park. And they came across a man named Connor Guilfoyle. And he was a teacher who had just finished his regular run. He told them that on the previous Wednesday, he had seen a woman matching Elaine's description and picture. On that Wednesday, August 22nd, Mr. Guilfoyle began his run at 6:11 p.m., and it took him about half an hour to complete it. There weren't many people in the park that day because it had been raining, pretty much off and on, but more on than off, I think. And just about 5 minutes into his run, he did see Elaine. He thought that she appeared to be lost. She asked him if there was a railway bridge nearby, and he pointed in the direction of the bridge for her. But Elaine had appeared to be very distracted, so he continued to run his usual route, which took him over the footbridge. And as he crossed the footbridge, he saw Elaine again. He made some eye contact with her and was going to say something friendly to her, but she showed no recognition of him and just kept walking off in direction of the shore. When interviewed, Elaine's family and her work colleagues told detectives that they didn't know of any men in her life at all. Detectives were interested in making a connection with her possible involvement in the BDSM scene. Frank did tell them about the comments Elaine had made years earlier about bondage and a married man, but then admitted that he hadn't believed her at the time because she did have a habit of making things up and exaggerating things.
Then when police spoke with the staff at St. Edmundsbury, her doctor confirmed that Elaine had expressed suicidal ideation, but she seemed in a very positive mood when she left us the day before she disappeared. The doctor did tell them about Elaine expressing interest in BDSM. She had explained that she had met a married man on one of the BDSM websites, and according to Elaine, this man had cut her and stabbed her with a small knife on more than one occasion. She had asked him to kill her when she was very depressed, but he had turned her down. Elaine had ended her relationship with this man, but then, in 2011, she said that she was back with him.
Well, detectives were able to find 8 men Elaine had met through different websites, and all of their cell numbers were on her iPhone. But Elaine had only actually met with 2 of them in person, and both of those men, when they were found, admitted that they did have sexual encounters with her, but they said they were no longer in contact with her at the time of her disappearance. One of these guys told a detective that he was incompatible with Elaine because she was into more extreme violence than he was. So that was a disturbing thing to hear,
I guess.
But the backgrounds and the alibis of the 2 men who had met her in person did check out.
Detectives ended up interviewing over 100 people and concluded that she had taken her own life. Her medical records, family, and co-workers all described Elaine as a troubled woman with a history of suicide attempts. She had been hospitalized for mental illness 14 times. The fact that Elaine had left the hospital right before her disappearance likely contributed to the conclusion that she had killed herself. The last known sighting of Elaine was of her walking alone toward the ocean, and she seemed preoccupied and distant at that time as well. And there were many people who were unsure if her story about the married architect was real or just a fantasy. So months passed. Elaine's case became less and less of a priority. The Garda station closed due to government cutbacks, and her case files were shipped to the Dundrum Garda station. A short time after Elaine disappeared, human remains were found on a nearby beach, but DNA analysis identified that deceased person as a woman who had jumped into the water a few months earlier. So this really just reinforced the idea that Elaine had killed herself. Her family grieved alone, just totally unsure about what had happened to her. Jill, what are you burning out here? Bodies?
Well, no. I'm throwing in all of our earbuds and headphones with a little bit of lighter fluid as my protest against podcast ads in my favorite shows. I'm just getting into a story or I'm dozing off and it's interrupted with commercials. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Nice movie reference. Anyway, let's just simmer down here. You do know that our True Crime Brewery listeners have the option to subscribe to our premium show for ad-free episodes and bonus episodes. right? It costs as little as $4 per month, and these contributions help support the cost of producing TCB.
Well, of course. I love and appreciate our subscribers. You know, I worked for weeks with our IT girl to set that up, and all because I have a deeply held belief that our listeners shouldn't have to hear ads.
That's well said. Now, let me ask you this. How are we going to record this week's episode without our headphones?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, you stay here. I'll go get the hose.
Okay, hurry.
Magali Vernet was a dog trainer with her own dog training and dog walking business, which she called Wonder Walkies.
That's cute.
Every day she walked between 3 and 7 dogs on privately owned forest land in the foothills of the Dublin Mountains. The owner of the property, Frank Doyle, had given her permission to use the land. So August 21st, 2013, which was a year after Elaine's disappearance, Magali's dog Millie went off-leash, disappeared into the woods. When she returned, she was carrying a long bone. And over the next couple of weeks, Millie regularly found bones in the forest, and Magali assumed that these were animal bones and left them behind.
So on Tuesday, September 10th, 2013, a local fisherman named Billy Fagan was on Sally's Bridge along the shoreline as the sun was setting. He was with his brother James and a friend, Mark Quinn. Billy leaned over the bridge to check the water levels when he saw a piece of yellow rope floating in the water. He also noticed a shiny object that looked like a metal ring. Mark used his 20-foot tension strap to try and retrieve these items, and he was able to hook onto the rope and pulled it up. Items caught in the rope included handcuffs, leg shackles, a bondage collar, a strap with a ball gag, and a black blindfold. They lowered the hook again and pulled up a vest, a blue top, and a tea towel. They wondered if these were items from a bachelor party, maybe? But they just left it all up on the rock wall and went home. But that night, Billy kept thinking about the items that they had found in the water, and he worried that something more sinister than a bachelor party might have been responsible for this. It was weird stuff to find. The following day, he returned, and the items were still there, so he picked them up, and he took them to the Roundwood Garda Station and gave them to an officer named James O'Donohue, and Officer O'Donohue put everything into evidence bags, so at least they took it seriously and didn't just ignore it. But the next day, the officer and Billy returned to the site where the items had been found, but that day the water was dark and murky due to high winds, so they decided to return when the weather was better. That Friday, September 13th, Magali and her dogs were on their daily walk when Millie disappeared into the forest again. So she didn't return when called, and Magali went in to get her. She ended up walking down a muddy path until she reached a clearing. And there she saw bones scattered all over the ground. And shockingly, there was a rib cage and a vertebrae. And she just tried to convince herself, well, maybe it came from a deer. But Millie was chewing on a bone further into the trees and wouldn't come when she was called. When she finally got to her, she saw that the bone was very large, almost like a human leg bone, maybe a femur. Plus, then she saw a pair of blue tracksuit pants among these remains. And Magali began to realize that she had come across human remains. So she picked up her dog and got into her vehicle, pretty freaked out.
I can imagine.
And she called the landowner, Frank Doyle, and told him what she had found. So Frank Doyle and a friend went to the area, and they found a jawbone with the teeth intact, so it obviously was human remains.
Yeah, and when the detectives arrived, they agreed that the remains were human. They found a rusty knife at the site as well. So they set up an investigation in that area. The remains had been there for an extended time, and animals had scattered the bones over the forest ground. So location-wise, looked like the person was a murder victim, because over the past several decades, human remains had been found dumped in this area. In the 1990s, the bodies of 2 women believed to have been killed by jealous boyfriends have been found near this location. I guess it has some rep, huh?
Not a good one, yeah.
Not a good one. Then along with the bones and track pants, they found adipocere. This is a white substance formed by water and fat tissue during decomposition. There were no soft tissue or internal organs found. So it was determined that the body had been on its back when decomposition began. And in the search, investigators recovered about 60% of the body. They did not find the skull or hand bones.
Right. When you say 60% of the body, you mean 60% of skeleton, pretty much.
Of the skeleton.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the cause of death couldn't be determined from the remains, and it was recorded as undetermined. The tracksuit bottoms were women's size 18, and from skeletal size and shape, the body was likely female. And this fusion of the first and second sacral vertebrae were complete, which meant that the victim was over 27 years of age. So the remains ended up being identified as a woman between 27 and 40 who wore a size 18, which would be a little bit on the chubby side. Bone marrow remaining and the partial preservation of the adipocere show that this woman had died about a year earlier. All these details matched Elaine. So she had disappeared over a year earlier and was believed to have drowned herself in the sea. But now it looked like she'd been murdered.
Yes, and that was the case. Elaine's dental records matched the recovered jaw. The O'Hara family was notified that her body had been found, and once her identity had been confirmed, the original case file was reopened. So Officer James O'Donohue returned to the water where the BDSM items had been found by the fishermen, and he did recover a set of keys, two supermarket loyalty cards, a leather mask, a large kitchen knife, an inhaler, a rope, and a rusted chain with a metal ring on it. And he took these items back to the station and put them into evidence bags along with the other stuff. So the Dunn Store Customer Service Department was contacted to get details from the loyalty card that was found. And it was identified as belonging to Elaine O'Hara. And when her name was run through the computer, that's when these officers learned that Elaine had been missing since August of 2012. And her remains had recently been recovered. So now investigators knew that someone involved in Elaine's murder had traveled to the other side of the Dublin Mountains to dump her belongings. All of that bondage gear suggested that Elaine's death was connected to her interest and her involvement in BDSM. The case was passed to the Eastern Division because they covered the area where Elaine had last been seen alive. Detective Inspector Duffy and Detective Sergeant Woods were appointed as the senior investigators on the case, and Woods was in charge of the investigation. There was a follow-up search of the water where the items had been found by the fishermen, and they found a second knife, a red and black backpack, a leather collar, some more sex toys, and a roll of black duct tape. So that's just a lot of stuff.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it goes on and on.
So Elaine's apartment was sealed off since it was the third crime scene in this case. Now, the apartment had been repossessed because of non-payment since Elaine's death, but it hadn't been rented, and it was unoccupied. So when the bed sheet was pulled back from the mattress, there were puncture marks on it and bloodstains. The bedding then was taken for forensic examination. So they didn't look that closely at this apartment a year before when Elaine first went missing.
Yeah, I don't think they took it as seriously as they might have.
Yeah.
Yes, probably because of her mental health history. Which should have made them more concerned, I think.
Well, yes and no. I mean, with her mental health history, you figure she probably killed herself. So that takes some urgency out of it. You're not trying to track down a murder suspect.
I still think that's a large assumption, because I feel like with her mental health history, she was very vulnerable.
Oh, certainly.
Very vulnerable to anyone who wanted to manipulate her, especially if she was meeting men online in these bondage sites. It's very risky.
Quite.
So as the investigation came together, it did become apparent that Elaine had gone to meet her killer. And her killer had somehow convinced her to leave behind her cigarettes and her iPhone, maybe to make it look like she had left to kill herself. So if she had planned to die, she would have known she wouldn't need those items, and she might leave them behind. But this just showed a really unusual meticulousness and attention to detail in the mind of her killer. In addition to finding Elaine's killer, the investigators also had the challenge of determining how she had been killed. The postmortem couldn't identify the cause of death. Under Ireland's laws, someone can only be convicted of murder if the state proves the guilty act combined with a guilty mind to create criminal liability. so it had to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused had premeditated the murder and also followed through with it. Once they were able to identify the killer, they'd still have to put together enough circumstantial evidence to convict them, and it would be challenging.
It'd be a big challenge. So detectives studied Elaine's missing persons case file. They felt that her killer had to be someone in the data taken from Elaine's computers and phones, and her statements to her father about the married guy who liked to tie her up and who she had asked to kill her became pretty significant now. And a therapist at St. Edmundsbury Hospital told detectives about Elaine's self-harming history and her interest in BDSM. She had shown the therapist cuts, superficial but still cuts, on her abdomen, legs, and arms. And she had admitted to cutting herself, and she said that she knew a man who sometimes cut her. And she described the man as married, with a child, but never mentioned a name.
Well, a former inpatient who had spent time in the hospital with Elaine recognized her photo on TV, and she called in to the detectives. She had met Elaine 6 years earlier at the hospital, and they had become friendly. She remembered Elaine as a lonely person with very poor self-esteem, and she had lost touch with Elaine about 6 months before Elaine disappeared in 2012. But she did remember something disturbing from their last conversation. Elaine had mentioned to her that she had been involved with a man she met over the internet. And this woman remembered Elaine telling her that the man had children. Elaine had also said he was an architect and that the relationship was purely physical. So this man inflicted pain on Elaine by cutting her, and Elaine had even shown her the cuts on her abdomen. This woman said that she had tried to convince Elaine to keep notes about this guy, and she asked detectives to look for these notes among Elaine's things. She was so concerned that she allowed officers to access her own medical records to help them determine the date of her last meeting with Elaine. She was really convinced that the married man had killed Elaine, and she wanted justice for her former friend. So she had a very strong feeling about it.
She did. Then a nurse from the hospital told investigators that she had known Elaine since her first admission at age 16, many years ago.
Yes.
On the night before Elaine's discharge in 2012, Elaine told the nurse that she was pissed off at a man who had been constantly calling her to get her to participate in bondage. This man had a key to her apartment, and Elaine seemed afraid of him. But she hadn't gone to the police because the man had kids and she didn't want them to be hurt.
So isn't that sad that she was trying to protect his children, not even knowing them?
Right.
Yeah.
While he's cutting her and doing all sorts of degrading things to her.
Yes, exactly. It's just very sad to think about that, because she wanted to have her own kids and a family.
Now, they looked at over 200 days of CCTV footage from Elaine's apartment, nearly 5,300 hours of footage on 10 separate cameras.
So that's a big job to do.
This is a gargantuan job. Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah, they had a whole team of people over a long period of time just to look through that.
Yeah, it covered 4 entrance doors, parking area, and the parking garage. Fortunately, the hard drives with the footage had been saved when Elaine was reported missing.
Yeah, so that was really lucky. So
that's a big break.
Yes.
So watching the footage, as you said, was a long, tedious, boring job. But a man caught the attention of the investigators. On June 23rd, 2012, Elaine arrived home at 6:54 p.m., 10 minutes later, a man entered the lobby, and when he was in there, he covered his hand when he chose a floor in front of the elevators, so he was hiding the floor he was looking to go to, and he also kept his back to the camera. And then he was seen leaving at 8:18 p.m., and after seeing this, investigators decided to keep an eye out for this guy.
Well, a second site about 500 yards from where Elaine's remains had been found was searched on September 21st. And at this location, they found hacksaw blades, duct tape, twine, fishing line, cable ties, a harness, and a shovel. Detectives suspected that this area had been used for the bondage of Elaine. She may have been here with her killer before, but, you know, Elaine didn't seem to know the way there.
No.
Her killer may have had the shovel with the intention of burying her, but tree roots underground there made digging really, really difficult. So the killer may have just given up on that idea and decided to hide her body in the forest, where her remains were eventually recovered. but he had gotten away with it in many ways because it had been a year before they found the remains, and then they were almost purely skeletal.
Yeah, there wasn't much to see other than recovering bones.
So recovering hidden material in Elaine's computers and phone was also a big job they took on. Over 4,000 SMS messages were extracted from the hard drive of her MacBook, and over half of these were between Elaine's number and an unidentified number. The unidentified number was in Elaine's contacts under the name David, and the number assigned to David was a phone that had been bought in March of 2011, and it was a prepaid Nokia phone. The registration name was Garun Caseholm. Records showed this phone had been used to contact Elaine, and it was last activated on July 12, 2012. And they would learn that Garun Caseholm was a fake name, so had been bought under a fake identity. The messages between Elaine's phone and the prepaid Garun phone made it obvious that this was the man Elaine had told her hospital friend about. The messages told the story of a master-servant relationship with grotesque subject matter. The man, Master, had graphic exchanges with his slave, Elaine. They wrote to one another about stabbing, rape, bloodletting, pain, and murder. The Master repeatedly wrote about his wish to stab Elaine to death. Just 2 hours after that phone had been purchased, the man contacted Elaine. And it was clear that the two had previous BDSM involvement, and he wanted to start it back up. So let's go over a portion of the exchange that happened on March 25th of 2012. Now, why don't we do it? You be the man and I'll be the woman.
Okay.
So here's how the exchange went.
Hi, Elaine. Hope you're keeping well.
Who's this, please?
Sorry, I may have the wrong number. Is this Elaine O'Hara?
I don't have your number programmed in. Who is this?
This is an old friend. We used to play together, and I miss it terribly. Would love to catch up.
Did I see you in the shopping center the other day?
Do you live near me? I have others.
Possible last week. I didn't go over, tried to get you out of my mind, but can't.
David.
Yes, it is you. I knew it. I'm not into blood anymore.
Yes, rang you from a call box to see if you were alive.
I'm alive and kicking, so what can I do for you?
Would love to start over. Have you a partner?
No, you're still doing. Saw you with you-know-who looking at a restaurant menu the other day.
There's a girl in the USA. Asked me to do something you asked me. Want to chat?
Sure, not today. I'm working in shop at 5. So you pick when.
Great. Tomorrow? What time suits?
I'm working till 2:30. I don't live where I used to, so where?
3, then. I've been watching your old place. Figured you moved. Do you still smoke? Still have dark thoughts? Your place?
Yes, I still smoke. I always have dark thoughts, but I'm able to cope with them now. Still smoke. I did give them up, but back on them. They're addictive.
See you then. Missed you.
Just to let you know, I'm not promising anything.
Hopefully. Do you ever think about me?
Honestly, yes, I do. But then I remember the blood.
Did you ever think I would surprise you and end it all?
No, I knew you wouldn't. You'd never come near me with anyone around.
If you ever see me again... I don't bite. See you tomorrow.
So follow-up communications showed that Elaine had easily fallen under this man's influence again. I mean, in the beginning there, she sounded like she was standing up for herself, but she caved very quickly.
Yes, it did briefly, very, very briefly, seem like she was not going to do anything with him.
Yes, but she was still willing to be his slave or his submissive. She did like to be restrained and tied up. But his interests were more violent than that. He liked blood and knives, and he wrote often about murder. Elaine didn't want to resume any knife play, but he eventually had reintroduced knives and stabbing her during sex, and she had allowed it. So between March 2011 and July 2012, he threatened her and constantly reminded her of how she had asked him to kill her before. He had refused back in 2008, but now he said he was eager to kill her. It's your fault that I want to kill you and you won't let me stab you, he wrote to her.
And then when Elaine argued against these demands, he said she was selfish. She complained that he didn't tie her up like she wanted to be. When she wrote that she wanted to find someone to love, he said, you're an old fat smoker who is too needy. He also exploited Elaine's desire to be a mother. promised to impregnate her as long as a child would never know who he was. And it was pretty clear that he felt safe behind this untraceable phone. He wrote about knives and murdering girls and how much he loved blood and stabbing. So he's just a nice guy.
So on March 30th, his text focused on his fantasy to kill an unnamed female from the United States. And he complained that he didn't have enough money to travel there to kill the woman. He wrote that he couldn't wait to sink his knife into flesh and see blood pour. So that's disturbing.
Just a bit.
Records of phone credit purchases showed that he had used over 150 euros between March 2011 and July 2012. A voucher was purchased from a deli in central Dublin in November of 2011, and the last voucher was purchased in South Dublin. But detectives continued to examine the CCTV images of the man at Elaine's apartment building. There was a breakthrough when the video showed the man entering the apartment building with Elaine O'Hara. So they were seen on camera entering the lobby together at 5:02 p.m. on July 9th. They stood apart as they waited for the elevator. He was in dark clothing with his hands in his pockets. He also had his head down and he was turned away from the camera, so he was clearly aware that it was there. And 38 minutes later, he left the building alone. Forensic examination of Elaine's electronics included searches of her MacBook, a compact computer, an HP notebook, and a Dell laptop, which Elaine had given away recently. So deleted files had to be put together to build a picture of how she had met her killer to find out who this guy was.
There were pictures of Elaine posing naked, showed injuries and scars on her trunk. There was a document titled Outline of Slave, which was a contract for slavery, from September 2010. The document was modified a couple minutes later, which suggested that it came from somewhere else and was transferred to Elaine's computer by email or USB.
Yeah, so this read in part, I'm offering 24/7 sadistic and brutal treatment for masochistic slaves. Slaves are property, possessions, meat. They are loved as a pet or as a cherished car. They are not a wife or a mistress. Slavery is a hard lifestyle to endure. You're not just a sex toy, but a complete package. You will be offered an annual slavery contract with no early release for any reason. You will either be kept in a heavy-duty steel cage or locked in a cell in my cellars. If you're good and collect merit awards, you'll have a real bed with a steel collar and chained in the room. Agreed limits will be in your contract and adhered to. Expect piercings, breast skewering, branding, breast suspension, and even a cattle prod. I have most equipment and toys and can build more to suit individual sizes. I'm not here for online fantasies, but for the real thing. If you have a fantasy you would like fulfilled, I will work out a practical way to achieve it. So that kind of spells it out.
It does.
Very graphically.
And for a naive person like me, it's just amazing.
Yeah, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's some stuff I'm not comfortable reading.
Okay.
So it's pretty disturbing.
We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, let's.
And then on Lane's devices, they also found pictures of mutilated bodies. There was a subfolder titled Killing, and this contained a series of photos of dead women, mostly hanged. From the content recovered, investigators suspected that Elaine could have met her killer as far back as 2007. There was an exchange in May 2011 that gave clues to who the man was who killed Elaine. In the text, he had written that he came in fifth in flying. And then after checking up on all registered pilots in Dublin without success, detectives looked into fly fishing competitions and model airplane flying.
So this was successful. Detectives found a fun fly event that had taken place on the Sunday before that text had been sent. A report on the event showed that the fifth place had gone to a man named Graham Dwyer. And this name was familiar. A diary entry from Elaine on June 30th of 2011 had a listing for Graham's phone number. And the name Graham and the phone number were also inside of a book that they found in Elaine's apartment. So a search for Graham Dwyer in the Garda computer system found a connection. He had been recorded as reporting his bike stolen from outside of his workplace. And that's a company called A&D Weichert. They found his home address in South Dublin. The cell phone analysis for the Garoon Nokia phone had been primarily used near a hotel that was close to Graham Dwyer's home address.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
A&D Waitrert was an architectural firm. And guess what? Graham Dwyer was a partner there. A picture from the Flying Competition magazine showed a man who closely matched the appearance of the man in Elaine's apartment on the CCTV footage. And further investigation showed that Graham was a married man with children. So Graham Dwyer was short, about 5'5", and he looked like a normal middle-class family man. He lived in an affluent suburb with his wife, who was also an architect. They had met in college. They had two young kids. Nothing in his history or his appearance suggested he was a killer. But once he was identified as a prime suspect, surveillance and monitoring of his phones started. So wherever he went, he was discreetly followed by detectives.
So his identity was only shared with those who were on the investigation team. They didn't want him to get wind that he was being watched. Although the media had reported on the items that were found in the water, which included Elaine's keys, Dwyer was not showing any concerns, at least nothing they could notice from his behavior. His persistence over a year and a half to plan and carry out Elaine's murder showed a really unusual amount of patience and single-mindedness. The texts were carefully built upon one another, the way an architect might write out a blueprint for a building project. But he also showed the desires and calculations of a serial killer in the making. Investigators believed he would kill again when given the opportunity, so they did feel there was a very urgent need to get him locked up. But there was a lot of work to do. Well, it's really the computer and the phone evidence that helped a lot.
Yes. So beginning in August of 2011, Dwyer had told Elaine that he had found someone to abduct and kill. So he texted Elaine and said they needed an untraceable prepaid phone. He wanted to make an appointment with the woman whose name was Rowena Quinn, and she was a real estate agent. Dwyer sent Elaine Quinn's phone number, and he told her to make an appointment to look at a house, and he would look there first to make sure there was no security cameras. But Elaine declined. She said it was too risky to do that. Dwyer said, "It's going to be okay. We'll hit her in the head with a hammer, drag her into a bedroom, gag her, rape her, and stab her to death." He said this in a little more graphic terms than I'm saying.
Yes. So pretty horrible.
Detectives intercepted some of Dwyer's texts and looked for his target. Rowena Quinn was an attractive blonde. She actually looked a lot like Dwyer's wife. And when Quinn was interviewed by detectives, her records showed that 16 people had looked at the house Dwyer mentioned. None of these people was named Elaine O'Hara or Graham Dwyer.
Which doesn't surprise me, because he wouldn't have used his real name.
No, he wouldn't have.
No. But Dwyer's text did suggest that Elaine's killer had only fantasized about killing before. After Dwyer was identified as the person texting on the recovered Nokia phone, investigators were able to track the phone's movements from 2012. The Nokia belonging to Master had been in Galway City on July 4th and then in South Dublin later that day. And after checking toll booth footage, the license plate numbers were run through the system, and a blue Audi registered to Graham Dwyer had actually driven through the tolls. They were also able to put together that the Master phone was consistently pinging on the same towers as Graham Dwyer's work phone. So they're connecting that.
Slowly but surely, they're building their case.
Yeah, it took a lot of circumstantial evidence to just build and build this case.
Yeah. CCTV footage showed Dwyer with Elaine in January, April, June, July, and August of 2012. On August 13th and 15th, he was seen arriving and leaving with a backpack that looked just like the one found in the water. Cell analysis also confirmed that there was a connection between Dwyer's master phone and work phone, matching up with his arrival in Elaine's apartment.
Yes, so this backpack, they were thinking, is kind of like a kill kit where he would keep his knives and things.
Yeah. So he's got all his equipment that he needs.
Yes. The phone records identified the location of the phones and also the times of the texts, but only the master phone or the SIM card would actually show them the texts that had been sent and received. A more detailed search of the water along that reservoir was approved, and they did it with an underwater metal detector. So it only took them an hour to find what they were looking for. They found a Nokia phone, 2 mobile phone batteries, a ski mask, and some anal plugs that they brought up.
Then a short distance from where these items were found, more items were brought up. This included another Nokia phone, a SIM card, and a pair of glasses. This phone was the master phone, once they got looking at it. Back at the Garda station, analysis of phone bill records showed that Dwyer had used his work phone to message Elaine's iPhone over 800 times between 2006 and 2012. The messages themselves couldn't be retrieved, but it did prove that Dwyer knew Elaine. He couldn't deny that he knew her.
Yeah, so that's a big step.
That's a biggie.
Investigation into BDSM sites revealed that Dwyer had 2 profiles on the alt.com website, and these profiles were Architect 77 and Architect 72. Elaine had actually viewed the Architect 77 profile several times, and using the email address submissive391@gmail.com, Elaine had emailed Architect 72 at fetishboy@gmail.com. One email from Fetishboy in 2008 was offering to kill Elaine when she was ready to die. So he was attracted to suicidal women because he thought he could groom them to be murdered by him. They would almost willingly go there for it.
Yeah.
But I don't think Elaine was willingly going there to be killed that day.
It doesn't. I know she has this long history, but it doesn't seem like that's what was in her mind.
No. She had been saying she didn't want to do the knife play, and she was excited about the tall ships.
Yeah.
She was just very easy to manipulate, unfortunately.
The Nokia phone that was recovered, belonging to Master, had only one contact saved in it, SLV, which it was interpreted as slave. Only 268 of over 1,300 texts could be recovered, but they provided important evidence, and they gave police the narrative leading up to Elaine's murder. On August 20th, as Elaine was preparing for her discharge from the hospital in 2 days, Dwyer was texting her and getting ready to see her. He texted Elaine that he was looking forward to seeing her on Wednesday. Elaine responded that she would not be stabbed. So he then offered her the choice of rough anal sex with choking. He also said he'd like to chain her up in the woods overnight. Then Elaine said, well, I'd really rather take the stabbing if those are my alternatives.
Isn't that sad?
Very.
I mean, I realize that some people like the BDSM stuff, but this is just more abusive to me.
It is.
Yeah.
So Dwyer wrote that he wanted to do it outdoors, but Elaine asked for it to be done indoors. She wrote that she was afraid he would kill her if they were outside.
So isn't that haunting?
Yeah.
That she wrote that?
And she asked him to keep the visible wounds to a minimum because she's going to volunteer at the Tall Ships Festival.
Yeah, she didn't want anyone to see her wounds.
The final text on the 21st of August was from the master to the slave. He wrote that he was going out to the spot to double-check it.
So Elaine was discharged from the hospital, and Elaine texted Dwyer and asked him not to talk about killing anymore until she was more settled into her life. She didn't think she could cope with it. Dwyer instructed her to take a bath, shave her body, and take a painkiller at 5 p.m., and he promised her that she would be in a lot of pain later. He said he was planning to stab her, and this time he wanted to see her blood. Then he told her to go back to the cemetery at 5:30 p.m., leaving behind her iPhone, but bringing with her her slave phone, which was the other Nokia phone. So Elaine had spent time with her father and niece that day until 4:24 p.m. Then she drove her car to the parking lot beneath her apartment building. At 4:55, Dwyer's work phone pinged at a tower near his office. Then it was apparently turned off. At 5:05 p.m., the CCTV cameras caught Elaine leaving her apartment for the last time. She sent a text to the master phone from her slave phone. She wanted his permission to bring her inhaler with her, but he refused. He told her to walk across the railway bridge into the park near the cliffs. At 6 p.m., Elaine received the last text from Master, which read, "Go down to the shore and wait." After that, both the master and slave phones were dead. They'd been shut down. Investigators believe that within an hour of that text, Graham Dwyer had lived out his fantasy of stabbing Elaine O'Hara to death. Over the footbridge, a footpath leads to the outer edges of the park. A small road is the only access point. They likely met there and walked into the forest. Only Dwyer knows exactly what he did to Elaine that day, but investigators narrowed the time frame to a 3-hour window. Dwyer's work phone was back on at 8:59 p.m., and he used it near his home. So it was a 55-minute drive to his neighborhood from the park, so the stabbing and murder likely lasted less than an hour. But by mid-October of 2013, Dwyer's arrest was imminent. A psychologist worked out a profile of Dwyer for the investigators who planned to do his interrogation. And this psychologist, she said that Dwyer was a narcissist who considered himself to be smarter than law enforcement. So one of those guys.
One of those guys. Investigators sent to arrest Dwyer arrived at his home around 7 in the morning on Thursday, October 17th. 1 dozen members of the team quietly got out of their vehicles, covered all the doors. Dwyer answered the door in his pajamas, and he looked confused and nervous. And once he identified himself, he was told that he was being arrested on suspicion of the murder of Elaine O'Hara on August 22nd, 2012. While this was going on, his wife Gemma came to the door. Dwyer was told to get dressed because they were taking him to the police station. They handed Gemma a search warrant for the home and vehicles. So she woke up their 2 young kids and made arrangements for them to stay with family members.
Well, the psychologist had predicted that Gemma likely knew nothing about her husband's crimes, or even that he was into this stuff. When she learned what he had done, she ended the marriage quickly, and Dwyer would never see his children again. A search team went to Dwyer's office to search and take laptops, USBs, and documents. And of course, his business partners were just as stunned as Gemma had been. This was a person who really had a double life going on. At the station, Dwyer was appointed a local legal aid attorney, and he was fingerprinted, photographed, and a DNA swab was taken from him. He was interviewed and insisted that he didn't know Elaine and he had not killed anyone. He really behaved as if he was insulted by the mere suggestion that he would have killed Elaine, and his primary concerns were for how the arrest would affect his marriage, his job, and his reputation. He really expressed no interest or sympathy for Elaine or any of her family, but he had a real attitude, and he was condescending to the officers. The second interview with Dwyer that afternoon began with him seeming more angry than anything else. He was upset that his arrest was in the media now. I guess he had some idea that he was going to be able to keep this all quiet and go back home and get back to life as normal.
Yeah, what was he thinking? Jeez.
But he was soon confronted with the evidence against him, and there was a lot of it. He learned how his phone use had been tracked, and he was shown the analysis of 5 cell phones. There was Elaine's iPhone. There was Dwyer's work phone. There were the master phone and the slave phone, and also that Garoon phone from before that he'd bought under that fake name.
And Dwyer was then shown a series of photos from the CCTV footage at Elaine's apartment building. The photos were put up on the walls of the interrogation room, and on the opposite wall, detectives had put up a diagram of the phone analysis. And this had arrows connecting the phones communicating and where they were located. Dwyer still insisted he had only heard of Elaine from the media, reports of her murder. He denied knowing Elaine at all. So Detective Peter Woods told Dwyer that Elaine had backed up her iPhone, including her text messages, to a laptop that they had. When Dwyer read through the messages, he became pale. Texts from Sir to Elaine referred to the birth of his daughter and even included the baby's name. Tough to wiggle out of that one.
It really is. There was a lot, though. After searching his home computer, investigators learned that he'd been watching a snuff film in which a woman was stabbed to death. So Dwyer admitted to watching what he called erotic horror films, but still insisted that he was not a killer and they had the wrong guy. Of course, he tried to downplay this film, but it was really horrible. It was a murder. A detective had visited Dwyer's former girlfriend, and she had shared some really disturbing and damaging information. She told the detective that when she and Dwyer lived together in Dublin in the early 1990s, Dwyer had told her that he had a fantasy about stabbing a woman during sex. I think that's when I would be out, but she stuck around. After that, he began bringing a kitchen knife into the bedroom. At first, he left it on the floor, but then he had to hold it. Now, he never actually stabbed her, but holding the knife became the only way he could have an orgasm. He had to have the knife in his hand. Now, this is a very trusting woman.
I guess.
But she had been living afraid of Dwyer now for 20 years, and she was able to identify him in the CCTV footage from Elaine's apartment building. When Dwyer was confronted with this information, he started to become uncomfortable. They could see visually that he was getting nervous. He had no idea how much they knew. There still was a lot more, though.
Yes, there was. Dwyer was then confronted with items that had been recovered from the water at the park, and he was shown the backpack and the photo from the CCTV footage, which showed him holding an identical backpack. So we got that. Biggest shock for Dwyer probably came when DNA testing was completed, and his DNA matched a semen stain from Elaine's mattress. Now, he did continue to deny killing Elaine, but Dwyer finally admitted that, yeah, he might have had sex with her a couple times. But he insisted he had never cut nor stabbed anyone. So over the course of four different interviews, it was confirmed that he had had sex with Elaine and that he was involved in BDSM with her. And he also admitted to having the backpack that was found in the water.
Well, over 30 video clips were found from Dwyer's phone as well. One was of Dwyer looking into the camera naked, and in this one he picks up a knife and pretends to stab himself. Turned out he just used ketchup as fake blood. He had no problem stabbing women, but he didn't want to hurt himself.
No, you might be too pretty for that.
In another clip, he was looking really groggy, and he said, "I'm just waking up after knocking myself out with chloroform." There were other clips of Dwyer having sex with different women who were tied up, chained, and gagged, and Elaine was in several of the clips. She was actually the woman who was in most of the clips. In one, Elaine was face down on a bed with her arms tied behind her back. Dwyer was naked and having sex with her from behind as he repeatedly stabbed her in her sides. Videos and stories written by Dwyer showed that he had a fascination with knives, blood, and killing, which goes right along with his texts.
It does. With the help of investigators in the United States, a woman written about in a story titled Killing Darcy was identified. She was an American woman from the state of Maine who had been in contact with Dwyer. She had met him online through a website about suicide, where this woman had been thinking of taking her own life, and Dwyer had offered to kill her after killing Elaine. In the fantasy he shared with Darcy, he said he would cut her throat as they were having sex.
So he'd written this long story, really graphic, really horrible, about how he was going to kill her. So the jury for his trial was set on January 19th of 2015, and his trial began shortly after that. There were a total of 408 witnesses subpoenaed by the state. In addition to CCTV footage and the phone records, the computer evidence was really expansive. The defense argued that the evidence was completely circumstantial. They put Elaine on trial, really, to a certain extent, because they focused on her sexual interests and her mental illness, trying to make her look bad, so blaming the victim in some ways. Dwyer's defense team argued that there was no evidence tying Dwyer to Elaine's death. She had a history of depression, and her cause of death had never been determined by the pathologist. She had recently been released from a psychiatric hospital, which she had entered after having suicidal thoughts. And both the Garda and her family had at first believed that she had committed suicide. So they argued that that is what happened. But the prosecution argued that the accumulated evidence showed a detailed plan by Dwyer to kill Elaine and get away with it. He had used her low self-esteem to manipulate her to do what he wanted. His urge to kill a woman was well documented in his texts and in computer evidence. Elaine had repeatedly told Dwyer she didn't want to be stabbed by him. What she really wanted was love, marriage, and a child. But knowing how insecure she was, Dwyer had pretty easily lured her to her death. He believed that if her body was found, her death would be considered a suicide. His attempts to hide his relationship with her by hiding the phones and the BDSM items that were found seemed really clear and very incriminating. Why would it be there if he hadn't done anything?
Exactly. Now, the trial lasted over 2 months. In March 2015, after 2 days of deliberations, Dwyer was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Even as the jury was deliberating, Dwyer was bragging to the guards that he would be free.
He really did seem to believe that. He was really delusional. He just didn't seem to think that he was going to be convicted, despite all this evidence.
Yeah, and sources have revealed that he was being considered as the killer of 2 other women and the disappearance of 1/3. Like you've said, it's not something that just pops up all of a sudden.
Right, yes. Well, the testimony from his wife and that ex-girlfriend.
Yeah, the ex-girlfriend
really
is pretty damning.
It is, and the wife, Gemma, actually the shovel they found, she was able to identify as belonging to her and Graham. And they actually were able to find paint on the shovel that matched some paint from their household. So that was pretty strong evidence as well.
And within an hour of his conviction, an arrogant Graham Dwyer issued a press statement through his lawyers. Now, there's no history of a convicted murderer ever doing this. Dwyer's letters said, "I wish to take this opportunity to formally thank my legal team, my solicitor Jonathan Dunphy, senior counsel Remy Farrell, barristers Ronan Kennedy and Kate McCormick, for their work and dedication since 2013. I also wish to thank my family, friends, and colleagues for their continued unwavering support through this period."
Yeah, that does not include his wife.
No.
No.
"To the members of the media, I am grateful for the privacy you have afforded both my family and people close to me during the trial. I now respectfully ask that you continue to respect their privacy, and I confirm that there will be no further comment by my family or myself concerning this case whatsoever. Thank you, Graham Dwyer."
So do you think he meant by that he wasn't going to appeal? He did end up trying to appeal, and it failed, but it kind of sounds like he was accepting it.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy to see he's not going to talk about it anymore.
Right, right. But I just think he's such a narcissistic person.
Yeah.
Yeah. That he wasn't just going to be apologetic or accept responsibility.
Not
at all.
Not even close.
No. But after the conviction, detectives did begin examining other unsolved fatal stabbings. These included the death of 17-year-old schoolgirl, Ronayd Murray, and she was killed after being attacked in Glenageary, South Dublin, after returning from a night out with friends in the pub. But no one has been convicted of her killing. A team of detectives reopened the file and went over texts between Dwyer and Elaine O'Hara. And in one series of texts, Dwyer told Elaine that no one had been charged and convicted with the girl's murder after Elaine told him she was afraid she would be caught if she set up a victim for him at his request. So that kind of implied it. Didn't say he did it, but there were some implications
there. There's certainly a suggestion of that.
Yeah, yeah. The court did hear a victim impact statement from Elaine's family, and in part this said, "It was heartbreaking for us to listen to the texts Elaine received from a depraved and diseased mind. The manipulation of her vulnerability was apparent, and when she tried to resist, she was reined back in." Of course, her father was just heartbroken. And I just see this whole thing as an extreme example of how the mentally ill are often manipulated and victimized by these people. She was just an easy target for him. Her psychologist had put her emotional maturity at the level of an adolescent, and that's at least partially because she was so heavily medicated in her teens, and she spent months and months in the psychiatric hospital, so she never really had a chance to socialize or grow up in a normal way.
No, she didn't.
So our sources for this case include the Irish Times News Archives, a book titled Almost the Perfect Murder by Paul Williams, 2 documentaries. The first one is a documentary on Primetime, the Graham Dwyer case, and the second one, Secrets of a Psychopath, the Murder of Elaine O'Hara. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. Just a quick reminder that we do have merch on sale on our website if you're looking for a t-shirt or a sweatshirt or a coffee mug or a beer glass, anything like that. And if you'd like to get your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each month, and get a free gift, you might want to consider subscribing to TieGrabber, and you do that by going to tiegrabber.com. Also, if you enjoy our show, we'd really appreciate your leaving a review on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen to us.
Okay, let's move to feedback. I've got a couple voicemails for you today, Jill, and a couple emails.
That's wonderful. I love getting voicemails.
So the first voicemail is from Liz, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, Jill and Dick. This is Liz, longtime listener now. How about doing an old case on Herman Tarnauer from Scarsdale Diet fame in New York, and then his longtime mistress killed him, and she went to prison, but she did something with prison reform. But it might be an interesting case, and I'm sure you could find a New York beer. Keep up the good work. Bye-bye.
All right, right to the point. Thanks, Liz.
It was right to the point.
Yeah.
We've talked about this case, Scarsdale Diet. Jean Harris was the mistress who murdered him.
Very famous older case,
very
yeah.
Very famous. So.
When was it? 70s or something?
In the 70s, yeah. So we're dancing around that. We probably are going to do it one of these days. Can't be any firmer than that.
Okay. I'm sure there must be plenty out there to research.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a very well-known case.
It is.
But sometimes if they're well-known and they're older, people haven't heard of it yet.
Well, no.
Right?
I mean, it's probably at least 40 years old.
Yeah, so.
So it might be.
The 30-somethings and 20-somethings probably never heard of it.
Maybe not.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Liz. And next we have comments, a beer suggestion, and a case suggestion from Aaron.
Aaron runs all over the place with this. He's got much to say.
All right. Let's hear it.
I can't thank you enough, Dick and Jill, for what a great podcast. I love the format, and you guys clearly have great chemistry on the show, wonderful research, and it's just a great conversation to listen in on. And even if it's a familiar case, I find myself intrigued by the human aspect and the commentary that you guys have, the expertise in the medical field that you input, and just good Q&A. One question was if you would ever consider doing recap or episodes that sort of review, hey, this was something that we did in 2016, say, and here's an update on it. We get it every once in a while, but I didn't know if a dedicated episode of that. Another idea I had for the website, which is beyond amazing. I love the simplicity of it, but I find myself wanting some sort of timeline or even a map widget of some kind that would kind of tell me when and where different cases that you've reviewed so far happened. I just think it's an interesting piece. I don't know if that's something that's doable or if I could even sign up to do that. And then beer recommendation. I hadn't seen this on your beers. It's one of my favorites, Bellhaven. It's a Scottish-based one, and Dick, I don't know if it matches your passes muster for what you would want in a beer, but I've always loved it a long time, and now they've got several different versions of it, which are also delightful. And the connection is my last name is a Scottish name, so I love that connection there. And then finally, the case... I would love to hear maybe a Devil in the White City, so H.H. Holmes, or your take on some of the older ones, even though it's relatively well-trod, like Jack the Ripper. And then the one suggestion I had is actually Craig Lloyd Graham from Canton, Illinois. In 1977, he passed away, disappeared and then passed away mysteriously. And it's a cold case that's never been prosecuted or anything. My reference for it is actually firsthand research and interviews that I've done. I would love to compile that, maybe even write a script.
Oh, he got cut off?
Yeah, it was right at
the three-minute mark?
The three-minute mark.
Okay. Well, thanks, Aaron. I'm blushing from all the compliments. That was really nice. Oh, the website. I don't know if we would actually do something with the locations, but I would like to expand our search engine so that you could put in a city or a country or something, and those cases would pop up for you. So I just haven't really gotten around to that. And then also...
Well, we talk all the time about doing follow-up on some of the cases.
We do, and I feel like it's just something I'm kind of lazy, I haven't done. But maybe if we took a week off here and there and we had the time to devote to it. But we really don't take much time off, so every week is filled with the case that we're doing that week.
Right.
I guess the week we did Die Hard was kind of a week off around Christmas, but we still worked. But yes, I would really like to do some follow-ups. And some of the big cases, there are cases we did in 2016, 2017, which I think about, oh, I wish I'd added this. I wish I'd talked about that.
Yeah, so we might want to do that sometime.
So some way of combining updates with other thoughts on it and things we might have missed. I think that's a great idea.
Very good.
So what do we know about the case he recommended?
The only thing I'm thinking, looks like Aaron's done a lot of research on it. And he got cut off, so maybe we ought to reach out to him and see what he's got. So, Aaron, if you're listening to this, your voice message got cut off as you were discussing the case. So if you would send us some more details, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, sure. If you have research you want to share and we end up doing the case, we will definitely give you credit for that, of course.
Absolutely.
And we appreciate that.
And the beer, the Belhaven beer, I've had some Belhaven, the Scotch Ale. Very nice beer. Very smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Good beer suggestion, Aaron.
Great. Have we done Scottish cases before?
I don't think so.
I know we've done Ireland a few times in England.
I think we've done some UK and Irish ones.
Yeah, I don't remember a Scottish one.
No Scottish or Wales cases.
But see, if I had that search engine tweaked, I could type in Scotland and I'd find out.
You'd probably find more than you wanted.
Okay. All right, so we have an email as well?
We have two emails.
Oh, two emails. All right.
Yeah, we had a lot of good stuff, so I wanted to put them in.
Okay, so do you want to read us Amanda's case suggestion?
So here's from Amanda, a book by Dana Middlebrook Samuelson called Clovis Road, The Dr. Roy Hunt Murder, Littlefield, Texas. This is a murder that happened many years ago but fascinated many people. The book is very detailed. But the murder was solved, but not solved. They convicted the wrong man, according to all who know the story.
Oh, interesting.
It's a small town in West Texas called Littlefield. And Amanda says, read the second edition of the book, because there's more facts and details. And I do love to hear your podcast. Keep talking. I love to listen. And she wants me to try her Shiner Bock beer. Independently brewed since 1909, Texas's oldest craft beer.
Okay, so we're talking about the second edition of a book on this case.
Yes.
And the case is about two doctors and nurses in a love triangle?
It's about a doctor and his wife who were killed. This is in like 1940, Texas.
Nice. So I like the older stuff.
Way old.
Sure.
So the doctor was shot. The wife was bludgeoned, I think. The interesting thing is that a year before, the doctor who had been murdered was shot by another doctor who thought that he was having an affair with that doctor's wife. That obviously those were non-fatal wounds. And then he turned up dead a year later. And the doctor who had shot him a year before had a solid alibi. He was not considered a suspect. They did have someone that they thought was very strong and likely to have done it. This person was killed in a shootout or a dispute in Oklahoma, so he never got charged with anything. So it looks interesting. I'll check into that.
Okay, sounds great. So our last email is from Elizabeth. It's another case suggestion. And Elizabeth writes, "Hello, Jill and Dick. I've been enjoying your podcast since earlier this year. I live in Worcester, UK, where a tragic event occurred in 1973 involving the death of three toddlers. The perpetrator was a young man called David McGreevy, who was lodging with the parents at the time. Just an idea if you wish to venture outside of the USA, where I lived for 5 years in Oklahoma and Connecticut. I really like the way you discuss these cases. It's very sensitive, respectful, and thought-provoking." Well, thank you very much, Elizabeth. We do like to venture outside of the USA on occasion, like we did today.
We just did.
Yeah.
Yes, we've done that.
So it sounds like there was a man living with a family and who killed three of their children?
Yeah, this was a guy, and I'll need to do some more research, but this was a troubled young man.
Obviously.
Who became quite violent when he drank alcohol.
Sure.
That is. And he had been kicked out of his house He was like a 20-year-old, young, fairly young guy. He'd been kicked out of his house and was living with a friend of his and his wife and their three kids. And the wife was a bartender, and he frequently babysat the kids. He was excellent with the kids. One night he went nuts and killed them, stabbed them, I believe. They were 4, 2, and 7 months or something like that. They were little kids.
That is scary. That's horrific. But I'll look into it. I don't know if I'll have the heart or the stomach for it, but I'll definitely look into it.
We'll do a little more checking.
Okie doke.
All right.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening and for sharing your feedback with us. We really appreciate it. We hope everyone's staying well and happy. And we'll see you next time at the Quiet End.
We've got a seat saved for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.